motivations for discussing this in the first place. So it may not surprise you that the research group of which I'm a part is interested in this problem. So the issue is that if the vacuum energy is tied to the space-time curvature in the way that's dictated by Einstein's equations, then we're forced into a situation where we need fine-tuning in order to explain the smallness of the observed dark energy. And before continuing, it's important to point out here that experimentalists, when measuring vacuum energy, are in fact measuring space-time curvature. And that's an important distinction to make because that's precisely the side of this relationship that we would like to alter. So by introducing extra dimensions, we can change the relationship between curvature and vacuum energy in such a way that potentially we can find some sort of natural way to get a small value for the observed dark energy. At first glance, it seems that such an option is already ruled out. If you want to have the energy be the scale of the observed dark energy, and you want to relate that to some characteristic length scale, you would plug in, you would use this usual sort of constant wavelength formula and find that you would need a length of the size of 65 micrometers. And current bounds on the size of large extra dimensions exclude that option. The bound's somewhere around 45. So we're above that bound.
What is
so, that? Oh, that gets an X. That's bad. But so right, yeah, right. So here, loop factors can make a significant difference, and so I neglected to make a small change here. The scale for the energy, in fact, doesn't change. I mean, that's observed. We can't change that. This factor of 4 pi is meant to be in the denominator, right-hand side of this equation. So by having a loop factor that's contributing in some way to this relationship, then you can evade that bound, at least for the time being. And that's an important thing to figure out. So these arguments by dimensional analysis will only take us so far. At a certain point, you want to sit down and do a real calculation using a real theory and try to figure out what the prediction is exactly. And so that's what I've been working on. So now that we've decided on the rough size of the extra dimensions that we'd like to introduce, the case of two extra dimensions is interesting because that puts the gravity scale at around 10 TeV. And that in itself is interesting for collider physics because it's readily testable at the LHC.
Readily is
built
into the
water. Well, yeah, this is true. This is true. Okay, so, well, and there's another motivation. Maybe this is a little bit more subjective. Supersymmetry for a long time has been used in the 4D context in predicting a whole slew of extra particles, which we have now placed very strong bounds on. What's interesting about this scenario is that we can put supersymmetry to use in a different context and potentially find a way to draw from its valuable properties, especially in addressing this issue of the vacuum energy. Okay, so my goal, I'm not exactly an impartial observer in this, but I would like to consider my role in this project as a bit of a reviewer might be in, you know, in the Consumer Reports magazine. So the idea is to take this proposed model out for a spin, do a real calculation of what the observed vacuum energy might be, and determine how well that works. So let me outline. Sorry, go ahead. He'd be a Ferrari. right. Yeah. So. So let me lay out the sort of the path that I'd like to take today, And so the first step is to introduce a particular model that we could use to study these issues. We're going to go through and discuss how you would go about calculating the one-loop 40 vacuum energy, at least in the case of a particular matter multiplet in that supersymmetric theory. And what we'll do is we'll go through and systematically identify the relevant brain and bulk counterterms that are necessary in order to renormalize the divergences that we calculate in the 40 vacuum energy. And well, then with the idea that we're always going to be applying back reaction, we're going to go through and work out whether or not the 4D vacuum energy indeed does remain small, as advertised by the points of this model. Okay, so, and before I start any of this, I want to just lay out three things that I hope people take away from the talk before I jump into things. So the first thing is that we can do loop calculations in models with codimension two brains. We're using these techniques to test naturalness in this particular codimension two model, which I'll describe in more detail in a minute. And throughout this entire discussion that I'll have today, brain back reaction is going to play a crucial role. And it's in fact, I can argue that it's necessary to understand brain back reaction if you want to understand the inner workings of extra-dimensional supersymmetry. Okay, so let me introduce the playground that we're using. So this is 60 chiral gauge supergravity. Chiral in the sense that all fermions that appear in this theory are chiral in the 60 sense. The gravity sector is going to contain the graviton, gravitino, a two-form gauge field, dilatino, and a dilaton.
So it's a subdual or anti-subdual?
Right. So if you're going to consider the minimal gravity multiplet, you would have a graviton, gravitino, and the self-dual part of that anti-symmetric tensor field. That theory doesn't have a Lagrangian description. You need to introduce its anti-self-dual part in order to do that. So then you extend the multiplet to include the anti-self-dual part, and also these spin half and spin zero pieces, the dilatino and dilaton, respectively. In the matter sector, we have a gauge multiplet, which consists of a gauge potential and a gaugino. And one of these will be a gauge multiplet, which gauges the R symmetry of this theory. And we'll use that that particular gauge potential to stabilize the extra dimensions. So by having some monopole background for that gauge field, we can ensure that these that the extra dimensional space is stable. So naturally, it'd like to expand, and the gauge potential will provide a repulsive force against that expansion. We also have a hypermultiplet, which consists of four real scalars and a hyperino. We've got to make sure we count our spin degrees of freedom properly there. Sorry about that. Did it here again as well. So three real scalars and a massive multiplet. We also have a massive gauge field, which in 60 has 5 spin degrees of freedom, and a complex gaugino with 8 spin degrees of freedom.
So in the business of matching, what are the supersymmetric partner of GMMP?
Yes. Yes. I think. Well, I mean, the two-form gauge field is a bosonic field.
I just mean like you're matching the gravitino with the graviton, the dilaton, the dilaton with the dilaton. What is matched up with the papermon?
Okay. I see. Let's go through and count real quick. So the dilatino has 4 spin degrees of freedom. The dilaton has 1. The graviton in 6 dimensions has 5 degrees of freedom. That's right. And then the two-form gauge field has 6 degrees of freedom, so 3 for the self-dual part, 3 for the anti-self-dual part. And the gravitino in 6 dimensions, that has 8 it's been used.
So, and then,
so we'll have 12 boson and 12.
You have set a subdual part, because that's what carries 3. It's
that's
3 plus 5.
Yeah, yeah.
How many supersymmetries are there?
This is a minimal supersymmetry in 6 dimensions.
How many supercharges?
So this is 8 real supercharges. So this is the bosonic Lagrangian that we're using. I haven't bothered to write out all the fermionic terms, but so that's the basic setup here. And the important features that'll come into play later are in particular the couplings for the dilaton to these fields, in particular the gauge kinetic term for the R symmetry, and also this prefactor that multiplies the potential for these hyperscalers. For those that are technically inclined, these hyperscalers live on a quaternionic manifold, so there's some structure there that I'm for the most part ignoring for this discussion, but I figured I'd mention it just now. So the background that we're going to set up for the extra dimensions is that of a rugby ball. So in the case where we were going to not include any brains, and in which case we wouldn't have anywhere to put our standard monophysics, you would have a spherical geometry in the extra dimensions. Instead, we're going to introduce two codimension two brains at the poles of this extra dimensional sphere, and those brains will act as a source for this geometry, and so they'll cause for there to be conical singularities at the poles. It's important to put the brains at the poles because then that configuration is stable. The brains will repel each other, and so they will remain fixed in that position if you start off with that sort of configuration. So we do that. We make our life easy. We also have axisymmetric symmetry. And there's no warping that's happening here between the brains. So that's another important thing to point out. The defect angle is the same at both brains. So a constraint for this simplified model is that this Lagrangian, L sub b, has to evaluate the same thing at both brains. So again, generically, you would think that might not necessarily be the case. I would agree. This is a simplified model where we can do exact calculations of the spectra for various fields. So we're making our life easy in that respect. So bear with me on that point. So let me talk a little bit more about how we're going to use this flux to stabilize the action dimensions. We start off with an ansatz that this gauge field, which is gauging the R symmetry, is only going to have some background in the extra dimensions. And what we would do is we would set up a brain Lagrangian, and rather than choosing some specific model to describe physics on the brain, what we'd like to do is do a general derivative expansion on the brain. So the first term would be a tension. It turns out the only term you can really write down with a single derivative in the case of codimension 2 is this brain localized flux term. So if I say that later on in the talk, that's what I mean. It's this single term that you can write down with a single derivative. And that term will serve, once we're including the effects of back reaction, that term will change the boundary conditions for the gauge potential, which is gauging R symmetry. And so we'll have to pay attention to what that coefficient is because it'll dictate to us the boundary conditions for that theory. And there's also some higher derivative terms which you can argue are going to be smaller, going to be suppressed in some specific sense. So let's talk about the effects of this brain localized flux. The first is what I said earlier, is going to alter the boundary conditions. More importantly, it also changes the flux quantization condition for your gauge field. So now here I've written out what the field strength is as a result of this flux quantization. Capital N is an integer, and phi represents the total flux. Let me talk a little bit about what phi is first. I sort of skipped that. Let's go back to the boundary conditions for a second here. So phi is different from the coefficient a sub b by a factor of 2 pi, but also more importantly, by a factor of e to the phi. And that'll play an important role in the discussion that follows. So let me make sure to point that out. now before we move on. But an important thing to note is that now even if you have zero flux quantum, you still have some non-zero field strength in the bulk as a result of these frame localized fluxes. So they play an important role, and back reaction is telling you that they have to be there if you want to do things in a self-consistent way. And also, since we're working in supergravity, there's a constraint that comes from the equations of motion on what this field strength needs to be. So it has some particular value, which then dictates relationships between capital N and phi. And since now, strictly speaking, this isn't the only relationship that you could have picked. It's only the quantity N minus phi, which is physically relevant here. So there's some leftover gauge degree of freedom. You can move flux from the bulk into the brains and back and forth. But we've made a specific choice here, one where if you take the limit of approaching a sphere, these brain localized fluxes would vanish. And so that's consistent with what you would expect, what you would want to have happen in the sphere limit where we know this theory is supersymmetric. This is coming, sorry, I am really glossing over this. It's coming from, if you write down the equations of motion for the 6D supergravity, they will force a constraint on what the field strength is, F, in terms of other parameters, including, for example, R, the size of the radius of these, I should mention. Okay, so I was really tempted to explain this story in the way that I discovered it the first time through. I did things the dumb way. This is a bad thing to admit. What happened was I had worked out the spectrum for various fields, summed them up, and figured out what their net contribution was to the 4D vacuum energy, found that it was zero. And that was really surprising. Looking back, it's a consequence of this accidental supersymmetry that I'm now going to explain. So let me describe that so that everybody has an idea of what I mean by that. After all, it's in the title of my talk, so I should probably mention it. A way to ensure that a given classical background is supersymmetric is to plug it into your SUSY transformations. And then if you find that the SUSY variations are zero, then that means that that background is supersymmetric. And for the case of interest here, we can ignore the variations of any bosonic fields. Because bosonic fields transform into fermionic fields, and fermionic fields have no classical background. So we can forget about those, and a lot of the hardware goes out the window right away. The important thing left to do is to consider the variation of fermionic fields, because those transform into bosonic fields, and we're tracking their dependence here. So let's go through the list here. If you would like delta chi to vanish, our background that we're considering here is assuming that the two-form gauge field is not really doing anything interesting for us. So GMNP is vanishing sort of by ansatz for these solutions that we're considering. The dilaton is also assumed to have no profile. So we're good. That's taken care of because phi doesn't vary. And so now if we look at the variation of lambda, we can make our life easier by using the equation of motion for the dilaton. You can sort of see by if you factor out a factor, the e to the minus phi over 2, then you can plug this in and see that there's some simplification that happens. At the end of the day, what you end up with is an algebraic condition on the form of this epsilon, this infinitesimal parameter that's parameterizing your SUSY variation. And it turns out that if you want to maintain a supersymmetric background, and you're looking at this variation of delta lambda, delta lambda, by the way, is the gauge. I'm not sure if everybody remembers my definitions for things. So chi is the dilatino, lambda is the gauge. And that algebraic condition tells you that not only does your spinner need to be chiral in the 60 sense, but it also needs to be chiral in the 40 sense. And so this four-dimensional spinner will have some definite chirality if you want to be living in a supersymmetric background. And so that in itself isn't a constraint, isn't too terrible. We can arrange for that to be the case. What's really interesting is when you start looking at the variation of the gravitino. What will happen there, there'll be some complication. I'm not going to work through the details. But you have a covariant derivative of epsilon. And of course, remember, our background gauge field is gauging the R symmetry. And so that means that our supersymmetry parameter is charged under R symmetry. And so that means that there's some non-trivial coupling in there as a result of this background gauge field. The background gauge field depends on those brain localized fluxes. And so by requiring for that covariant derivative to vanish, really, that's a constraint on what you would want those brain localized fluxes to be. And the constraint that you get is that they need to be equal, and they both have to be equal to half of the required value. Remember, this constraint here that I have in brackets comes from flux quantization. And so the extra constraint above this is that the fluxes are the same at each brain. And we have a dilaton, which can be used in order to dynamically tune these brain localized fluxes to satisfy this condition. And so that's an important part of this whole story. There's a leftover shift symmetry in the dilaton that remains unfixed because of the conformal symmetry of this 60 supergravity that we're looking at. And so you can shift phi in such a way that you arrange this to be true. So long as you start off with equal fluxes, you can dynamically flow to the region where you have a supersymmetric background. And this is surprising. The hindsight is 2020, right? So this is the one slide way of getting to that answer. That was the main interesting surprise that we found in doing this research. But there's a lot of much more interesting details that went along the way. So let me go through and tell you a little bit about the story of how these brains renormalize under these loops that we calculated. Let me not jump into that yet. Let me talk a little bit about why this is an interesting model we'll be talking about. The reason why we're even talking about loop calculations in this model is because it's been shown previously that the classical value for the 4D curvature, which is predicted by this theory, is zero. And so that this was done by Leo and Cliff, who are here. And this result, again, relied heavily on the use of back reaction. And it's something that would not have been, would have gone unnoticed otherwise. So let me give you a brief sketch of their argument. So here the idea is that if you're looking at 4D curvature, you can go through and calculate what that is from the equations of motion. And it turns out for the ansatz that we are making, that 4D curvature simplifies is simply just box phi. So this is a box of the dilaton. This is a total derivative. And so what that means is that we can then average that 4D curvature over the extra dimensions. And we get some specific value, which can be read off by thinking of sort of little Gaussian pillboxes, codimension one Gaussian pillboxes, which are going to encompass the conical singularities. And we can read off exactly what the 4D curvature is by doing this integral using the usual Gauss's theorem tricks. And what's even more interesting is that matching then tells you that the quantity that you get is related to the derivative of your brain Lagrangian with respect to the dilaton. And so since the brain Lagrangian is essentially a way to plug in boundary conditions for the theory, it's sufficient to choose your brain Lagrangian to be independent of the dilaton in order to ensure that the result of that averaging integral is zero, and then as a consequence, the 4D curvature is also zero at the classical level. And if you have a Gaussian pillbox, that would be the radius of that. That Gaussian circle pillbox thing that you're using in order to cap off the conical singularities. Yeah, the proper distance away from the brain. Right, and so that's how they obtain their results, sort of in a nutshell, in a one slide sort of story. So now let me jump into the calculation that we did, and I can give you. Yeah, sure. Right. So here, the all I'm saying is that the classical value predicted by this model for the 4D vacuum energy would be zero if you have brains that don't couple to the dilaton. And so we make the same assumption when we're doing these loop calculations. Yeah. In principle, there would be, yes. Let me see here. I think what's happening is that the singularities are in the derivative with respect to rho of phi. If you multiply by rho, then you'll pick off the finite part.
The left-hand side is non-zero, that means that there was a singularity in the solution at the position of the brain. And if it's zero, that's the special case of the conical singularity.
Okay, so let me jump into this one loop calculation that I've been working on. So here, the idea is to start off, I'm going to describe the story for hyperscalers. And we've also gone through and worked out results for spin half fields, spin one fields. So we can do all the matter multiplets in this theory explicitly. I'll describe the story for the hypermultiplet, and then we can sort of extend our intuition from there to consider the more general case. So here the action that we're taking is to the usual thing that I wrote down before for this model in the bulk, but then also this brain Lagrangian that we've been using to motivate the discussion up till now. The hyperscaler will couple to the R symmetry. It's charged under the R symmetry. And also, even though strictly speaking the hypermultiplet is massless, you do get some contribution from this potential. So there's an effective mass due to the curvature of these extra dimensions, which goes to zero in the case where these extra dimensions are very, very large. But for finite radii, there is some effective mass for the hypermultiplets that will follow. The calculation we'd like to do is to get this one loop effective action, the one PI usual thing, and so that's what we're going to do. More specifically, we're going to zoom in and focus in on its 4D potential. So we'll integrate that action, that 4D action, to get the 4D potential.
We have them a little confused. Here you're probably in four dimensions, but your indices are implying that this is a derivative in six dimensions.
Yeah, I'm a little confused myself right now that you're saying that.
V1 is going to come to you as an integral over two dimensions, right?
Pardon?
V1 is going to come to you as an integral over two more dimensions.
Do you secretly have an integral in V itself?
So strictly speaking, what we're doing is the full. I think this is what you would call the.
This way, sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
Is V restricted to the bulk or to the brain, or is V in the bulk altogether?
This is capturing contributions from bulk physics to the 4D vacuum energy.
Okay, so V is secretly actually an integral over the.
That's right. Yeah. So really, this started off as a six-dimensional integral. We've done the two-dimensional integral implicitly here, and that's contained inside the. Yeah. Thank you.
I feel like you said that these conditions for U1R.
Yes. Yeah.
Can that commutative charge under that?
Hypermultiplet? Yes. Yeah. If you.
Is it a U1R or is it a true R?
It's a U1R. Yeah. This is a. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's right.
The hyperinos are neutral, right? The hyperscalers are charged, the hyperinos are neutral, so it definitely is an R symmetry.
That's right. And then for gauge multiplets, it'll be the opposite, where the bosonic field is uncharged and the fermionic field is charged.
Okay. And you're hitting this Q is genetic?
The Q, no, that's fixed by your supersymmetry transformations, right? So if you go through and work out what the charge needs to be, assuming that epsilon has charge 1, then you can work out the corresponding charge of any other field the usual way. Okay, and so now if we go through, we can simplify things a bit. I'll be using dimensional regularization, and the parameter that I'll be dialing is the 4 dimensions. So here I change from a Euclidean 4-dimensional integral to a Euclidean d-dimensional integral, and I'll also be summing over the KK modes here. So that appears here in the so each KK mode will contribute to this one loop potential. I'm going to skip over a lot of the details of how to do this because a lot of it is it's fun to do, but it's probably not the best thing to spend time on right now. So the roughly speaking, the techniques were to use.
So is it correct to say that you get the effective action because the 60 part cancels out between the hyperinos and hypermultiplets, while but because they have different boundary conditions at the around the, I mean, because of the ground gauge field, there are different boundary conditions around the conical singularity, and then you get, so the cancellation does not happen in the bound.
Right.
Not happen at the
So the cancellation here is going to happen as a result of the fact that one of the fields will couple to the brain localized flux and the other will not. That's definitely, that does play a big role. Another major contribution is the fact that there is this effective mass for the hyperscalers, which shifts the KK spectrum by a certain constant amount. And that allows for the KK states to go from the case where they're unaligned to the case where they are aligned. And now see you have matching between bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom.
So
all
this
the way
is def for x. So the integral of this def for x is something that was originally integrated over the whole sphere, not just coming from the endpoints.
Which integral again, sorry?
As I say, when you write this one good terminal test, you can take all the for x of v.
Mm-hmm.
This v receives contribution, say, from the integral over the whole sphere.
Yes.
And from the...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There'll be bulk and brain contributions. And actually, if you wait a little bit, I'll tease out exactly what comes from what. Yeah.
What we expected to happen was what you said. We expected it to be that the brains were going to break supersymmetry and so we would find a failure to cancel because of that. So the surprise was the accidental supersymmetry, that in the case that the two brains have the same localized flux, even though we didn't make the brain around them supersymmetric, there's a residual supersymmetry that survives.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is that there still is a cancellation unless you make the two brains have different flux.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little bit more supersymmetric than you would have thought might be.
Okay, so yeah, I was just going to give a brief outline of how this calculation goes about. So we'll do some sort of heat curl expansion, which allows us to separate out the integral here from the sum that we'd also like to do. So that's a helpful step. We also need to figure out what spectrum it is that we're summing over, and we can do that by solving an extra dimensional version of the equation that spherical harmonics behave satisfy. But in the case of a rugby ball, not just a sphere. Then we're going to sum over that KK spectrum. And there, the technique of Poisson resummation came in handy in order to make that sum meaningful. And at the end of the day, we're going to take the limit as d goes to 4, and we'll find that there's some divergent piece. And the coefficient of that divergent piece is given by this below. And it also tells us the mu dependence of the one loop calculation that we're doing. So that's an important thing to point out at this spot. Another important thing to note is that generically you get contributions which don't all satisfy the property that you'd like. What we like are contributions that are roughly this size. And so here the size of this one loop contribution to the vacuum energy is the size of the KK scale, which is great. That's what we'd like. That's right around the EV scale. So factors of 4 pi, for example, like these, might get us close to the observed value of the dark energy as we'd like. The problematic things are these m squareds, m to the fourth, m to the sixth terms, which generically are there if you aren't considering a supersymmetric theory. So what we'd like to do is find a way to suppress those contributions and only be left with this 1 over the r to the fourth contribution. And let me give you a result for these coefficients here. So I have S to the minus 1, which is going to end up being the simplest. This is the most UV divergent thing. And then they'll progressively get more and more complicated. They're not very enlightening. They're my babies, but they're not very enlightening. So S to the minus 1 is very simple. It's simply it comes to you with a volume factor of alpha. Now I'll explain a little bit more what that means. They all have that same volume factor. You can see everything's proportional to alpha here. And then as you go down the list, you get more and more complicated. At the end of the fourth level up here, you get no contributions that are dependent on the gauge field. And as you go to m squared, you start to grow things that have an n squared contribution. This is the field strength, roughly speaking. And you also get things that are proportional to n, both in the case of m squared and also m squared over r squared and also 1 over r to the fourth. And so those are the main things I wanted to point out on this slide. The rest of it is just jargon. So the nice thing, the thing that makes this task manageable for us is that we can consider the renormalization of the bulk in using whatever boundary conditions that we like, because the renormalization of the bulk should be independent of the boundary conditions. It should be depending only on local physics that's in the bulk that is far away in principle from our boundaries. And so let's make our life easy then. Let's work with a sphere, and then we can simplify these coefficients. And so if I were to flip back to my previous slide, you could pretty easily read off what all these coefficients are in the case of a sphere. And that's helpful. So here, before I flip through, things like S1 here, you can notice I've split it into two terms. I'm doing that just for organizational purposes. They're both proportional to m squared over r squared, like I showed on the previous slide. This one doesn't depend on n squared. So this extra 2 in the superscript is just counting the number of powers of the field strength to which that particular contribution is proportional. OK, so it turns out these are the required bulk counter terms that you would need. In principle, what you would do is you'd write down the most general Lagrangian that you could think up of. And it turns out that these are the only ones that are relevant for canceling these divergences that we found up here in the case of a sphere. And we can go through and sort of see how it's going to work. I've ordered them so that there's 6 things up here, and there's 6 terms here in our Lagrangian. And each one's going to renormalize each particular S that I have listed up top. So here, for example, a 6D cosmological constant can serve to renormalize S minus 1 in the case of a sphere. And remember, that was the simplest one. And then you can sort of go down the list. You have factors of Riemann. Here, I'm using a fancy notation. All we really know is that the overall renormalization of all the things that you could write down that have 2 powers of Riemann in them are going to renormalize this term. So we know it's scaling with r, the little r, the radius of the extra dimensions. But we don't really know anything more about how each individual term renormalizes. Well, in the bulk, that actually, I should back up from that. In the bulk, that's been worked out in detail by Gilkey and DeWitt. So that is known. Let me backtrack that and save those comments because they definitely apply on the brain. The similar terms appear there. So here, again, things that are dependent on the gauge field, not surprisingly, get renormalized by a term which is has the square of the gauge kinetic function. Here, wherever you see a factor of r, you can think 1 over r squared. The classical equations of motion are telling you that the curvature goes like 1 over r squared. And also, from the equations of motion or supergravity, the field strength is going like 1 over r squared as well. So here, for example, let's pick one at random. I kind of like this one. So here, you would have 2 factors of 1 over r squared. So this is proportional to 1 over r to the fourth. You multiply by a volume factor in order to get the 4D effective potential or counterterm potential. And so the whole thing, including that volume factor, goes like 1 over r squared. And sure enough, that's canceling a contribution in S1, which is proportional to n squared over r squared. In fact, that's how we're reading all these things off. Okay. So that dependence on the radius is what it's allowing us to tease out these relationships. Okay. And so now that we have that information, remember, the coefficient of the UV divergent part that we're renormalizing is also the coefficient of the logarithm of mu in our calculation of the one loop effective potential. And so what that means is that we can read off what the mu dependence of the renormalized couplings would have to be in order to cancel that explicit mu dependence that we get in our one loop result. And so that gives us the following beta functions, which can be worked out once and for all. And the nice thing is that they apply not only in this case, remember the title of this slide, these results are independent of the boundary conditions. So then we can go back and consider the more general case and separate out the things that we already understand and know and love, the sphere case, from those things that are more complicated. So that's what we do next. Now the brain normalization, again, by arguments because of locality, the renormalization of brain physics is going to be dependent only on brain physics. And so for example, you wouldn't expect a contribution to the renormalization coming from the opposite brain, because that would be non-local. And we're looking at UV divergences. Those are all expected to be local things in this calculation. And sure enough, that assumption holds true. So what we can do now is go back to our original coefficients and subtract off what we have for the sphere multiplied by this extra volume factor of alpha. And what's left would be a sum over contributions that are coming from brains to each one of these Gilkey coefficients. And so now we can go through and read off what these coefficients are, and also what counterterms would be required in order to renormalize those divergences. And important thing to notice here is that there's no delta SI if you're considering S to the minus 1. Remember, S minus 1 was the simplest one. It was just alpha. And so the sphere result takes care of that exactly. And that's good, because the brain counterterms can't generate anything that's proportional to R squared. You no longer have a volume factor here when you're considering brain physics. This is already a four-dimensional Lagrangian. You're not going to integrate it over the extra dimensions. And so the biggest contribution you can get is independent of R. And so that's the end of the fourth term. And just as luck would have it, that's the first situation in which you would need to cancel some sort of divergence from these delta SIs. So this is working out nicely. And you can sort of imagine how each one of these would scale. For example, this term here has a factor of Riemann, so that's 1 over r squared times f. That's another factor of 1 over r squared. So this whole term would be proportional to 1 over r to the fourth. That would be canceling off some delta s, which is contributing to s2. That's the one that goes away, 1 over r to the fourth. Yeah?
Because you have like some extensive curvature terms? Not just the curvature of the bulk is picked up to the brain, but the shape of the brain.
Yeah, I think those terms in principle would be there on the brain. I think if you evaluate them at the classical background, you find that they vanish, if I'm not mistaken. And so what happens is that they don't contribute to this one loop effective action. So you could put them in, you'd evaluate them, they'd give you zero, and so there'd be no way for them to contribute in canceling any divergences. But in principle, they would be there. Yeah, we don't have the ability to track how they were normalized in this calculation. And so rather than going through and listing off how all these terms are normalized, it all gets really messy. So let me just spare you some slides of horror. I'll do the two simplest ones here. This is how the tension and the brain localized flux are normalized. These are the ones that we started off with, so they're near and dear to our hearts. And we can get a sort of general sense for how things are working. The important thing to note is that here you're not getting some sort of sum over the brains like we had in the total coefficients up here. You're renormalizing, and the coefficients that appear in that renormalization are coming from the particular brain that you're normalizing. So here, if this was the north brain, B would be plus, and this would only be phi plus here. There would be no phi minuses, and there would be no tensions from the opposite brain or anything like that. And the same thing holds true, in fact, for all of these coefficients, regardless of their complicated nature. Yeah.
So when you started the discussion, you only considered the epsilon dot f term, the single derivative.
Mm-hmm.
And my impression was that, that told you what background you have, and that was important for the accidental supersymmetry. because those are the only bosonic backgrounds you have.
Yeah.
But now you have all the other bosonic backgrounds.
Yeah.
Isn't there some fine tuning that you need to have to make sure that those are zero when you move the supersymmetry?
Right.
Fine tuning in a.
No, I think I understand the nature of your question. And I think there's two ways to address it.
Well, let's put it this way. If any one of them is partial to M, then you do have some serious fine tuning.
Well, in principle, yeah, that's right. But if you wanted to do things in a consistent way, what you'd have to do is start off with those terms at the classical level. And so we'd have to back up. If we wanted to include those terms, we'd have to go back to the classical level, put them in, solve for a consistent background, including those terms, and then continue with our one loop story from that point. Technically, that ends up being quite a pain. We're working on it. It's not that we're not working on it. It's a valid concern. Another thing that can happen is you start with them zero at the classical level, you'll grow them. And so that's what we're showing.
What you really want to show is that, I mean, you take the one loop correction, that is roughly the value that you will generically have,
mm-hmm.
right? And mm-hmm. then if your supersymmetry is now spoiled by that amount, that is the amount of...
Actually, that's another way to address this. In the case of a supersymmetric background, something really interesting happens. Both of these two terms, if you just do the naive power counting, they both go like 1 over r squared. So this, in principle, they normalize like m squared over r squared, right? Like what we have here. And for the Brain Laplace flux. And what's interesting is that they individually renormalize in such a way that their net contribution to the 4D effective vacuum energy is just zero. And so there's a situation where you start off with, for example, R that isn't there. You do one loop calculation, you grow R, and you also run A in such a way that you get a net contribution to the cosmological constant, which is zero, which is interesting.
So it isn't half a BS brain or maybe BS brain. Does it mean that I've guessed that several counterterms are a little bit supersymmetric? I mean, you should be able to rewrite these in superspace.
Yeah. Actually, thank you for reminding me, because that's something I meant to emphasize and didn't. There is no requirement for supersymmetry on the brains. We're doing a derivative expansion. We're writing down the most general things up to some order in a derivative expansion. We're not enforcing any sort of supersymmetry on the brains. It's coming to us by accident, hence accidental supersymmetry. It's something that we have yet to get a full handle on. It might be that there's some fermionic terms that are vanishing at the classical background that make the brain Lagrangian supersymmetric. That's not something that I have a concrete answer about yet, but it's definitely something that would be interesting to look into.
This relation will be starting between the second and the third coefficient.
Mm-hmm.
Does one follow some supersymmetry or not?
Their running is... I guess if you knew the running of one, you could predict the running of the other if you knew that supersymmetry was there.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's probably true that supersymmetry would impose a relationship between those two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a similar sort of thing happens in the bulk, and there it's a lot more concrete, right? In the bulk, you have terms that go like r squared and f squared, and those terms are related through anomaly cancellation.
So this brain is half BS because they're supposed to be charges?
Pardon me?
So when you split charges, does it make
four? Four complex superchargers, that's right.
So if you have eight real superchargers in the bulk, the brain is at most half, right?
Oh, I see what you mean. Right. So once you impose the condition, right. That's I forgot about that. So now when we have a, we are down to four real superchargers.
So
that's
right. Be able to write this in any power superspace, four dimensional superspace.
In principle, yeah. If you were going to write out a supersymmetric Lagrangian,
also for half-BS defects, people have this formalism where you sort of treat the bulk fields, decompose the, organize the bulk fields into multiplets for the preserved supersymmetry only. And then you can write bulk. Defect Lagrangians, which involve bulk fields in it.
I've played that game in the codimension one case with just a four-dimensional Wes Amina model.
Yes.
And that it's true that you can decompose things in that way. It'd be interesting to follow that through. Thank you.
But it's also true that the bulk breaks out of the central here too, right? the brain was preserving half, but the pulse was also preserving half. You had a chiral condition for your epsilon and your distinctive condition for the sphere.
That's right. That's right.
So the gamma 5, epsilon 5 is equal to plus minus epsilon 5?
Yeah. So of the 8 supercharges that were there to start with, the sphere also broke 4 of them. And then left you with an n equals 1 supercentury in 4 dimensions. And now the brains are not. So the accident was that if you had just the first two terms in the brain, then if the magnetic charge is related to the tension, so it sounds like a BPS condition, then you preserve that 1 supersymmetry. And that's the accidental part is that that adjustment is not an adjustment of the parameters of the Lagrangian, it's that the flux depends on the flat direction, and so it dynamically chooses the BPS condition. So that's what preserves the supersymmetry. But it's true that the other terms, the higher degree terms, would break it if you just wrote generic ones. And so that's kind of what you're after is what's how big is the dominant supersymmetry breaking?
If your classical configuration was a supersymmetry, then you can the one correction to break it.
Well, because the thing is that the rules that we're starting with is that the brain of Lagrangian is not being restricted to be supersymmetric, so just some generic non-supersymmetric Lagrangian. So it should be, its boundary conditions should be doing what you said at the very beginning. They should be ruining supersymmetry because of boundary conditions, and so you should be getting a non-zero corrections to them. And then the surprise is that if you just took the first two terms, for free, you don't break the supersymmetry. But generically, you eventually do break it. So that then the question is, how bad would you break it?
Is it just boundary conditions, or you're imagining putting the standard model on top of this brain, which is not supersymmetric?
From the point of view of the bulk, it's boundary conditions, but the point of view of the things on the brain is not supersymmetric at all. Yes, so the standard model wouldn't be jammed at the center.
Okay, so I don't have a lot of time left, but what I'd like to do is just sort of give you a rough outline of exactly how this cancellation is happening. So here we can follow, for example, this tension here. We worked out how the hyperscaler normalizes, and we know that we have 4 real hyperscalers, so they would give you some contribution like this. And the hyperino is uncharged, so you notice that it's the renormalization of T, in that case, doesn't depend on the brain localized fluxes. It turns out if you add these together, and you impose this condition here, that both fluxes are equal to plus or minus 1/2 of that deficit angle, then you get that the net running of the tension is just 0. And that happens because it's the only operator that'll give you something like m to the fourth. If there were 2 or 3 operators, like in the case of m squared over r squared of 1 over the fourth, then you would end up having some sort of situation where they would each individually normalize in such a way that they combine to give some sort of 0 net renormalization. But here, there's only one term that goes like m to the fourth, so that's they vanish identically when you add them up. So that's roughly how things are working. So this isn't quite the full story. So once we obtain results for how all these couplings are running, what we'd want to do is run the couplings and then see what sort of phi dependence we grow. Remember, at the beginning of the story, I told you that in the classical case, it was sufficient to require that the brains were independent of the dilaton in order to have 0 cosmological constant. So if we don't grow any dependence on e to the phi through renormalization, then we expect to still get 0. And in fact, in the case of massless multiplets, you don't grow any e to the phi dependence because the e to the phi dependence enters from the mass dependence of what your multiplets are. So in the case of massless multiplets, they just don't change the results. So you need to introduce some sort of e to the phi dependence, and a massive matter multiplet will do that. In that case, again, at the one loop level, you're vanishing when you have balanced fluxes. So you need some parameter. This would be the BPS-like parameter here, this eta. And so if eta is 0, then you have supersymmetry. And if eta is non-zero, then you don't. And when you don't, then you get this net contribution once you take back reaction into account in the way prescribed by Leo and Cliff. And you get some net result. Which happens to be positive in particular regimes for capital M. But at this point, we would prefer to do a calculation when we're sitting in the supersymmetric situation and we grow some sort of breaking of supersymmetry, possibly at the two-loop level. And that's the subject of current study. But this is a way to get a non-vanishing vacuum energy in the one-loop calculation that we've done. Okay. Right, so I think I said that. Let me just reiterate the take-home messages that I had outlined previously. So the The first was that we can do loop calculations with co-dimension two brains. And this is something that was understood in the bulk for a while, first done by Gilkey and DeWitt. But now we can also track the renormalization of brain parameters. And so this is an improvement on that pretty impressive calculation. And the second take-home message is that we're in the process of using these techniques in order to study the naturalness of these co-dimension two models that are supersymmetric, and attempting to figure out how they might address naturalness in four dimensions. The third take-home message is that brain-back reaction is crucial to understanding extra-dimensional symmetry. Recall that if we hadn't done any discussion about brain localized fluxes and how they influenced plus quantization or anything like that, then none of this accidental supersymmetry would have arose, and we would have indeed found, like in the pure tension case, that supersymmetry is broken by these brains. This is a really good example of how it's important to be consistent when you're working in an extra-dimensional model and to include the effects of brain back reaction while performing those calculations. So on that note, thank you very much for your attention, and I'm open for questions.
So what's the worst case scenario? What's the biggest effect you can get?
I have pet ideas about that. I don't like to share too much in public, but
the worst case scenario is you get the wrong sign.
I can be pretty twisted. That's true. No, I think the worst case scenario would be that if you're always being consistent in the order to which you're working in the brain Lagrangian, it might be that you always have a supersymmetric theory at the end of the day. That would guarantee that you're getting zero to all orders. And somehow that doesn't seem plausible, because you can put in non-supersymmetric physics by hand on the brain. Then again, the properties of these systems aren't very well known. So the intuition may break down. And for example, this accidental supersymmetry was something that was not expected to occur before it did. And so there's a lot of complicated work that needs to be done, but that's a logical possibility. So it might be that, you know, somebody goes and does the two calculation and goes through a whole bunch of work to find out that it's zero. And that'd be unfortunate.
Well, it would still be pretty impressive, but zero, right? I mean, it would mean that there is some sort of dynamical mechanism that even if you put non-supersymmetric stuff on the brain,
yeah,
the whole setup is driving you into, I mean, this is like the original Wagner ball, right? That somehow have this dynamical mechanism to.
Yeah, I should point out, having said what I just said, I have some confirmation bias. Okay, this is I'm by no means an expert in this field. This is the first calculation that I've really done on this material. Up until about a year ago, I was doing phenomenology stuff. So this is something that is something that's virgin territory for me as well. And so I may not have the best intuition for how things are going to happen at the two-loop level.
In particular, though, the supersymmetry required the fluxes to be the same in both brains. And you would have thought that, say, the standard model lives on one brain and not on the other one. Loops on the brain are going to renormalize the... Well, eventually, you're going to get something which renormalizes the brain localized flux on that brain that doesn't get tracked by the other brain. So sooner or later, you're going to have supersymmetry brain coming from somewhere.
Yeah.
So actually, I had a question for you about exactly that. So if you don't have the same flux, you said you will flow to the same flux. What exactly do you mean by that?
So you have to start off with equal fluxes. You can't get away from that. What you can do is start off with fluxes that aren't necessarily equal to the value required by the equations of motion. E to the phi, again, has a shift symmetry, and it'll move to wherever the minimum reaction is, right? And your equation of motion telling you it's over here, it's going to go over there, right?
Okay.
And so that's how that's working. But you do have to start off with equal fluxes to have that work. There's only one e to the phi that multiplies both coefficients. Yeah. One other thing to say about the case of unequal fluxes is that we're starting off with the, we're already putting in a bias into the theory by requiring a Rory ball background, right? And so they within that setup, we're assuming there's no warping, and you have this this reflection symmetry about the equator, and so that you would expect that if you wanted to introduce generic fluxes, you would want to still obey the symmetry that you started off with, and so it seems sort of inconsistent in a sense to put in unequal fluxes. That's why I'm sort of semi-unimpressed with the result that we get at the one-loop level, just because of that fact. But that's the way it is.
It's good. Hating on your own result is always a good thing.